Well, hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to the episode 4 of the Apologue podcast. My name is Simon Head, and I'll be your host. Episode 4. Who would have known? Episode 4. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by FetchClass.com. FetchClass.com is a teaching and learning system. It's a website dedicated for an online video conferencing chat, so you can teach and be taught in the privacy of your own home. It's good for people like right now. I'm looking outside. It's snowing like crazy. Again, snowing. And it's good if you don't want to drive across town. And it's good if you just want to hook up with your teacher, learn, and then get on with your life. FetchClass.com. Come on by. Come see us. That's FETCHClass.com. David Quinton Steinberg, everybody. Hey everybody, how you doing? My name is Simon. This is the Apologue podcast, and this is episode number 4. And today I am downtown Toronto. I took the trip all the way down to the TD building, and I am here speaking in a boardroom like a very awesome businessman, looking out into the cityscape with David Quinton Steinberg. David, how are you doing? We go back a long time. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks awesome. For having me.
Well, thanks for having me. I got to tell you, coming down to the city and recording a podcast is kind of a neat experience for me. I'm very new at this, and you have a very interesting life now and in the past. And it seems like you've always kind of wanted to do what you wanted to do. And that's why we're here. We're going to talk to you a little bit about the love of music, the cash, and where it all fits together, and sure. how you can balance it. So let's go back. Let's go back, way back to the 70s. Okay. When did you first start playing music?
I started playing drums when I was 11 years old. So that is 43 years.
43 years.
There's been a lot of mileage put on the fingers and the wrists and the arms. So I started playing as a little kid, and I became obsessed with rock and roll very, very young age.
What age, what year was this around?
I started playing, I guess, about 1971. But me, like a lot of other people, had that experience of having an older brother or sister, in my case, an older sister, who had a good record collection. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're a young guy, you go and you check out what your sister has. And she had some really, really cool stuff. And I basically was brought up on her record collection.
And what was that?
Oh, there was really cool things in there. Traffic, John Barleycorn Must Die, Frank Zappa, Hot Rats, Laura Nero, Spirit, The 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus, The Guess Who, American Woman. Yeah. So like really quite really, eclectic.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
Because really. I never knew anybody who like Zappa would actually like The Guess Who.
Or Cat Stevens.
Yeah.
So I grew up on that really wild mix of stuff, and always wanted to play rock and roll, always wanted to be in a band from the age of 11. I never thought about doing anything else.
First drum kit?
First drum kit was 1950 Slingerland marching bass drum with a matching snare drum.
The hat
that my father brought, and the bass drum would roll around on me in the in my bedroom, and I learned to play drums that way. And then when I was 13, I got my first real drum set that my father helped me pay for, and it was a Premier kit, which. I really wanted to have because that's what Keith Moon played.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And was it like go to the department store? Was there a music store? Like, was it sort of an experience? Like, we're going to go and actually, the other question is, did you saved up and your dad must have instilled some? Okay, if you save up and I'll help you. You know, get you the rest over the cliff to pay it. I'm in the same boat with my kids when it comes to video games or whatever. Okay, you try to make as much as you can, and then I'll.
Exactly. I mean, in fact, I have an incredibly vivid memory of my first drum set and how we got it. I even remember how much I paid. It was $120, and my father put in the rest, and it was probably, you know, $250 or something. Mm-hmm. And it was the Paul Robson Drum Shop on Bayview, a small drum store where they also gave drum lessons. And he had these two premier kits. One of them was had a sort of a black diamond type covering, and the other had this gold covering. Mm-hmm. And I went with the gold.
Oh, wow.
Because I always liked the flashy stuff. Always.
Even to this day.
Oh, yeah. It never stopped. I don't know why. It's just the way I am.
Well, hey, you know, that's... and you must have gotten your first band together around then. Like, if you own a drum kit... You are in any band. Doesn't matter how good or bad you are. You know, and you can just join a band. Same thing with bass. When I first started playing bass, my bass was a piece of crap, but he owns a bass. Nobody else plays bass.
Yeah, yeah. You know, so let's get that guy.
Let's get that guy.
It's like the guy who owns a van or who has access to his father's van. My first band is actually quite an amazing tale simply because of who was in the band. It was my neighbor, Joe Rockman, who lived right across the street from me. He played with Jeff Healy through Jeff's mm-hmm. entire career. Mm-hmm. And Michael Zweig, who lived around the corner from me, was the guitar player and singer, and Michael plays now with Burton Cummings. So when you think it was me, Joe, and Mike, we were pretty good at 15, 16 years old.
Gosh.
And after that, I put a band together with Jamie Gray, James Gray, I called him Jamie, who was in Blue Rodeo for many years. And funnily enough, it was very much sort of a progressive rock sort of thing when we were young kids.
And what were they called? What was it?
Syndrome.
The Syndrome.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I was trying to look around, you know, because I was saying off the recording, I'm not much of an interviewer, but I'm getting better. And I love when people kind of have done many, many interviews. I can tell you've done so many reps of interviews that you can kind of just steer this along. I love it. I love it. I'm just here to, you know, I hit record.
And basically what I do is access a file in my brain.
Yeah.
It's like all the stuff's filed there. I just got to access
it. Get it going in the right spot. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah. And the whole idea, like playing music as a kid, did you think ever that you'd be sitting in this nice building sitting? It was always just a let's do it for kicks and see what happens.
Well, actually, not. It wasn't so much that, Simon. I seriously thought that's what I would do with my life.
It's your vision.
I didn't want to do anything else, period. So it was very difficult for my parents to have a kid like me in high school, because quite frankly, if it had nothing to do with rock and roll, I couldn't have cared less. Mm-hmm. And my notebooks were full of doodling of band logos, and Slade and the mm-hmm. Sweet and Kiss and Humble Pie and all that. Mm-hmm. That's all I thought about. Mm-hmm. And those were my heroes, and that's all I read about. Mm-hmm. So I fully, fully expected that that's what I would do with my life. I never thought in a million years I'd be here.
Did you think there's some childlike naivety pushes you through so many what ifs? If I was smarter, if I studied a little harder in school, that's always a joke at work where I'm at, where it's like, right. If I just studied a little bit harder, maybe I'd be teaching these kids and not actually, you know, picking up the chairs for them. You know what I mean? But there's for you, do you think there's a little bit of I can do this and screw you? And there's still a little bit of that 15-year-old in you that says fuck everything, I'm just going to go and do it and see what happens.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that actually being involved with the punk new wave scene in my late teens also formed part of my personality. And mm-hmm. part of who I am, even to this day, comes from that. Mm-hmm. That sort of do-it-yourself attitude. I can do it. There are no rules. There are no boxes. Go away. I'll do what I want.
Yeah.
There, so you know, in a nice way, I think that I took part of that from being in that scene, because you have to remember that that was a very unique time in music when we were rejecting all the things that had become successful, that were larger than life, they were being rejected by us so that we could make our own music. Mm-hmm. And here in Canada, it was it wasn't a political movement, it was a musical political movement. Yeah.
And it's 75 through 78 era we're talking about right now.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're 17 and you're like, and at 17 is tricky enough anyways, because you're trying to tell someone, I know what I'm talking about when you're 17. You know what I mean? Like, nobody
knows. When you know nothing.
My joke is kids are stupid. It's up to us to make them smart. Or smarter than us. You know what I mean? They're stupid. When they have the whole sort of my little, you know, I call them helicopter parents, or they come in like this, and I say, well, kids are dumb.
Yeah.
And it's up to you to make them smarter. You know what I mean? And it sounds like you had a really good, you know, your parents were supportive for the most part.
They were incredibly liberal. Especially for the time. You know, I have two parents that were born in 1930 who didn't grow up with rock music or rock and roll, as they called it, I guess. And no, they were incredibly liberal and cool. However, they planted these seeds in me that were very much all about doing something respectable at some point in your life so that you could survive.
Yeah.
You know, a big thing with them was survival. And I remember my mother in a particularly sad time for me when I was, you know, struggling in my early 20s. You know, what should I do? Should I stay in music? She gave me this little piece of silver and said, here, I'm giving this to you so you'll always have something.
Oh.
You know, yeah. And I was like, oh boy, they literally think that I'm going to be in trouble as a 30-year-old, 40-year-old, 50-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that is support beyond support, because not only are they letting you live your life and live your dream, but they're also giving you this, I think it's so charming to say, here's what we think you need to sort of, it's a symbolic thing, and a piece of silver is a piece of silver. It's worth nothing, but it says something like, you know, here you go. And I, you know, I'm in the same boat. I moved to Winnipeg as a teenager or as a 20-year-old something, and my parents came and saw me, and I'm like trying to make it work, trying to make it work, trying to make this go. And it's a tough go, you know. And I think if you stick around long enough, I think people learn to okay, I'm going to back to it. Because I think you got to be a good guy to begin with. Mm-hmm. You got to be somewhat of a person that can hold a conversation, who can not be a dick in the bar, who someone isn't that violent drunk.
You're right.
These are the people that I think that I try to keep myself associated with. And I think you as a person, you are who you are. And this is kind of what got you to where you are now, which is just not being a dick.
Yeah. I mean, I think in many ways it sounds kind of trite and contrived, but you are who you are your whole life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can see stuff in my kids who are 19 and 14 that existed when they were babies. I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
It's, and I'm sure you can too with your children. And, you know, so there are certain things that you're sort of built with that are in the DNA that you're not going to change, you know. And my thing with music is, and it still is to this day, when I talk to people that are aspiring, is what is it that you're trying to get from it? Mm-hmm. What is it for you?
Is it the money?
Is it fame and fortune? Is it notoriety? Is it because of ego? Is it a spiritual journey? What is it for you that you want this for? Mm-hmm. What is the purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I remember very, very distinctly as when I was already really involved in music, 17, 18, playing, touring, saying to myself, what I want is the career of John Cale.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want. Mm-hmm. I want to be able to make a record every year. I want to be able to play live and bring in enough people to sustain a career. I remember thinking that would be the ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But now as an entertainment lawyer for the last 24 years, I realized that was not the ideal. That is not an easy life.
No.
It's not easy.
No. And someone who is an innovator, it's the old story. Whoever innovates doesn't necessarily make it monetarily department.
That's right.
Will inspire the next whoever to that will go on and then capitalize on it.
Yeah.
And I think that's who we are as people, as a society. There are people that are givers and the people that are takers.
Yeah.
People take an idea and call it their own and then move on to make millions.
Yeah.
Now, the person that created it, all you have is who you were.
yeah.
to say, oh, well, wait a minute, put your hand up and say, I started that. And,
right.
you know, and there's no reason for to be like completely bitter about it because you maybe you move something along. No, living in an apartment somewhere.
Well, it's like you're describing Big Star.
Yeah.
And, you know, I watched the documentary on Big Star the mm-hmm. other day.
How many bands did they influence?
No, basically a whole genre
Absolutely.
Came out of it,
yeah.
which
yeah.
was the alt-rock,
Midwest.
REM
yeah.
type thing. For better or for worse, yeah. that's what came out of those guys. But the thing is as I'm watching the documentary, and I loved Big Star as a kid, and I loved a lot of that power pop stuff, the mm-hmm. Raspberries, Blue Ash, etc. Mm-hmm. But Big Star had, number one, a terrible name, an absolutely terrible name. Mm-hmm. Let's be serious.
Yeah.
They called their first album Number One Record. That is the stupidest, dumbest idea I could ever think of. And then their next album was called Radio City. Mm-hmm. Again, super dumb.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they had no image. So these were guys that wore jeans and t-shirts who were nondescript looking with a bad name and bad album titles who did brilliant music.
Yeah.
And I always say, think about however many kind of people in music that you know and love, and take any of them. Mm-hmm. Take Geddy Lee, mm-hmm. who we were just talking about
yeah,
before
yeah.
of a show. What if his name was Joe Smith? Mm-hmm. Would that have had any impact whatsoever
nope.
on the brand of him?
Or? There'd have to be a middle name in there, like awesome.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
It's so much is attached to the branding of things
yeah.
and how they're developed that way. And so Big Star, it's tragic because I don't think anybody was sort of helping them along in that way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. They literally did start a whole movement and but couldn't hold the flag.
Beautiful music though.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah. Yeah. And but you talk of power pop days and things like that, and it's so funny because my power pop started in the late 70s and
mm-hmm.
and I have like several, there's a few moments in my life that completely changed who I ended up, who I am, and became the reason for who I am. And one of them is Pulling Muscles from Michelle by Squeeze,
mm.
I Got You by Split Enz, and then it turned into Iron Maiden, and then in later on metal and things like that. But the very beginning of Switching to Glide by the Kings, you know, things like that, that's sort of
okay,
like
yeah.
that type of power pop to me is what I really clammed onto in the early days of my, you know, being a musician or whatever, enjoying music. Music was on the radio.
Yeah.
Back in those days.
That's right.
And I'm reading up on you because I feel like I have to because you've done so much in your life. But opening for Squeeze, that must have been a total trip because now that's a band that people, I wonder how much money's left on the table for them to actually, you know, put it back together and do it. And I know they yeah. did an album in the 90s or something.
Right.
Like that. Or did
well,
they do something?
They were funny.
Later?
They started, I remember buying their first EP, mm-hmm. which was an independent thing that they put out during the punk years. And I just thought they were a punk band.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, it definitely had that kind of punky edge to it, their first stuff that they recorded. But it, you could also tell that they could really play and write songs.
Mm-hmm.
Our gig with them is memorable for me because it was the last show of the Mods, mm-hmm. which was my band in those days. And we had a very nice following locally. And we had played in various cities in the U.S. and through Canada. But we did very, very well locally. That was our last show, was playing the music hall, and we were open for Squeeze. And I remember, you know, there was kind of a big kerfuffle locally. It was a simulcast on CFNY and all that sort of stuff. And the guys from Squeeze, I remember them coming to the side of the stage and saying, what's this all about? Like, why is everybody making such a big deal? And somebody explained to them, oh, it's this local band, you know, that have had a following, that are breaking up. This is their last show. Oh, okay, now we get it. Little guys in Squeeze.
Yeah.
Little short dudes. And not that I'm tall, but... and they were amazing. They were amazing. They played great. I remember watching their set that night, and they were fabulous. And we'd opened for the Police at the New Music Hall as well.
Yeah.
In 70... It must have been 79.
His post when everybody saw them at the Rivoli?
Not the Rivoli. They played the Horseshoe.
Horseshoe. Yeah.
Now, it's funny. 19 people I believe were at the Horseshoe show when they did that, and three of them were three guys from the Mods.
Oh, that's crazy.
And the reason I remember that so distinctly is Elvis Costello was playing at the O'Keefe Center that night. All the Mods went to see the Elvis Costello show. Mm-hmm. At the end of the show, we're walking out of there, and the guy said, there's this black reggae band playing at the Horseshoe from England. We want to go. Because those guys loved reggae, the other guys in the Mods. I wasn't that big a fan of reggae, and I said, well, I'm not going. I'm going home. Oh. And they went. And the next day, they said it wasn't a black reggae band. It was these three white guys from England.
Yeah, pale guys,
and they were amazing. And I was like, really? Crap. And then they came back and played The Edge a couple times. Then they did the New Music Hall, where we played with them. And then they did Massey Hall.
Right.
And Maple Leaf Gardens. I mean, they just went
fast.
A trajectory straight up to the clouds.
Yeah,
you know?
It was like me and Caius. I should have gone seen Caius at the Rivoli. Or Primus at the Rivoli.
Primus.
And I didn't see it. Or Nirvana at the Opera House.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and Scream was opening, and it was like, oh no, the Melvins opened.
Oh, okay.
The Melvins opened for Nirvana at the, just as Teen Spirit was like exploding. I'm like, I've missed more than I've seen that I can actually have a really awesome like story to tell.
Yeah, but, same here.
Yeah.
I've missed a lot of good ones.
So you could have seen the Police, but you were like, screw it. I don't want to see.
Yeah, I didn't feel. Yeah, I didn't feel like seeing them. Of course, by the time we opened for them, they were doing their second album, and we all knew who they were at that point.
Yeah.
I knew the first record really well, and I was never a huge giant fan of theirs or anything, but they were obviously good, and they.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out of that scene, I had my favorite bands, you know, from 77 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
I loved Television, the Marquee Moon album. I loved the Dead Boys, Young, Loud, and Snotty. I really liked The Damned.
Yeah,
I liked 999. I liked The Clash. Loved the Sex Pistols record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the things that I was really, really into. The Police were a little light for me. At that point in my life, you know.
I was trying to have a lengthy debate with somebody over The Clash and punk rock.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, so were The Clash punk rock? Because is punk rock a lifestyle? Is it a musical genre? Is it a fashion statement?
Right.
And the answer is, well, I don't know. But my thing about being into punk rock, it's more of a lifestyle. So therefore, it's unfortunate that people get pissed off when their favorite bands make it. You know what I mean? And that's call it selling out or whatever.
Oh, for sure.
But The Clash, I think they get a free pass. You know what I mean?
They do. I mean, it's interesting because if you were around at the time, The Clash were definitely one of the first that made a record.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out and they were definitely inspired by the Ramones. You could hear it in the sound. And and I remember when they did their second album and Sandy Pearlman produced it, the U.S. producer, people were already using that sellout expression about them because they were daring to make a commercial record.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the fact is all those guys wanted to be rock stars. All those guys wanted to make commercial records. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of them were capable of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just kind of the way it is. So people get jealous or they get weird.
Yeah.
You know, the whole concept of selling out is fascinating to me because I was at the last Pogo premiere, you know, the documentary, and I appear in this documentary. I'm sitting there watching the premiere, and in one of the interview segments that I did, I talk about wanting to move on at a certain point and not wanting to be, you know, mired in the problems that people can have when they don't know when the right time is to get out of music. And I said, listen, I wanted a wife and a car and a house and a mouse and a whatever, right? I wanted that. And if that's selling out, I sold out. And some punk in the audience from the day, who knew me from the day, said, you are a sellout. Screams it out in the theater.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, and what are you? What have you done with your life exactly?
Yeah.
So wait, there's supposed to be something positive about remaining who you were 35 years ago, holding this flag that lands you in a single room without enough money to buy a friggin' sub sandwich And what? That's noble? This is noble?
Yeah.
Yes. I don't get that.
Yeah.
Because to me, survival is noble.
Yes. And, you know, you should, it's a bad human trait to be mad at someone's misfortunes. Mm-hmm. So therefore, it's equally as bad for someone's good favor. You know, if someone makes, you know, I have friends who are millionaires, you know, who've sold millions of records.
Yeah.
And the people and they're the same people that I knew when I was driving around in a van, like in the early 2000s. And those are the people I think it's who they've become. But they live in nice big houses, but they're still the same people. Because they're comfortable with who they are.
Yeah, and I mean, I wasn't angry about it. I thought it was a little bit funny at the time. Mm-hmm. And I also felt badly for him because mm-hmm. I know where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult. But I see life as a great big long journey where you're visiting certain things, right? And it's a visitation, a tasting of different aspects. Mm-hmm. And if you can get out alive, you know, visit and get out alive. Mm-hmm. I played with Stiv Bators for a year and a half, 2 years. I go in, I visit, I come out.
Right.
Right? And that's the way it's always been with music. I go in and I visit and I come out.
And playing with the Dead Boys, too, must have been equally, because you were fans of them to be able to join and... You know,
yeah, I mean,
it was a crazy way how you joined too, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, to make a long, long story very, very short, Stiv wanted to do a solo album in the summer of 1979 in Los Angeles. It was supposed to be Jerry Nolan on some tracks, the drummer from New York Dolls. Paul Cook and Steve Jones from Sex Pistols on some tracks, etc. And it didn't turn out that way. I ended up going down with Stiv's friend Frank Sesich, who was from Blue Ash, and his friend Eddie Best, and we recorded four tracks in the summer of 79 and had a great time. But, you know, a year and a half before that, I was buying the Dead Boys record on Yonge Street, and I was a huge fan of theirs. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was like... it was like a little mini version of that movie, that terrible movie that was made, Rockstar, I think called.
Marky Mark.
Yeah. Where you end up in your one of your favorite bands.
And you end up like meeting these people and going, well, these are fucking douchebags. Yeah.
And I loved Stiv. But yeah, it was pretty weird. And the guys were so much older than me. I mean, Bators was 11 years older than
me. Did they call you the kid? Oh, it's the kid.
Well, Stiv used to call me Fresh Meat.
Oh, gosh.
That's what he used to call me. And, you know, let's face it, when you're 30 and you've got an 18-year-old in your band, that's a big spread. So he was like sort of my mildly psychotic big brother.
Right,
you know, during that period.
Did a little mentoring, too, about, you know, maybe reverse mentoring, like here's not how to live and, you know, and things like that. Or
well, he had a funny way of looking at the world, and he was, he actually would have gotten along really well right now in the world of social media because he was a conspiracy theorist. Mm. And he had hilarious conspiracy theories because everything with Stiv always had an element of humor to it, no matter how serious it was. Right. So even his conspiracy theories were somewhat funny. you know, he used to say to me, we would be traveling on the road in the United States, you know, passing McDonald's after McDonald's. And he would say, you know what those are? And I'd say, what? He goes, those are feeding stations. He goes, that's the government. They're getting us used to eating the same food that in anywhere in the country, it's all the same. And they're training us to eat at feeding stations. You know, that was one of his conspiracy theories. And but his other conspiracy theory, which he actually put in some of his lyrics, interestingly enough, was that video games, which were just starting at the time, Space Invaders and Asteroids, Bators absolutely believed that was a government conspiracy to train young people to fight cyber wars. And because he thought there'll be war if it's going to be fought in outer space. And
with drones.
And drones and satellites. And he said they're training the kids to do this. And now you read...
Not so far off.
No. Now you read about people that are in the army that have been brought up on video games and are really, really good at shooting stuff.
They're in Italy flying a drone somewhere over the Middle East and bombing stuff. Wow.
So it could be funny, but it could also be sort of insightful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Nostradamus of sorts, yeah. I think, there's a case study done on violence in video games, and they've kind of dropped the whole, you're going to go and grab a gun and start shooting people because that's what you did in Duke Nukem. Because I remember in the 90s when third-person shooting games started coming into a full effect and they started looking like real games. So people were up in arms. Oh, my God, people are going to start acting out like these video games, you know. And now it's, my son, it's crazy. I'm so monitored. I'm like that monitoring parent, but he wants to get the Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah.
And I saw some trailers on it, and there's people getting lit on fire.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And this is what people his age, and he's 11 years old, these people play these games. But they're not going to go out and start lighting people on fire. You know what I mean? There's a line where your mind says, if you're a crazy person, you're going to go do crazy things.
Yeah. I think societally, there's been for the past several generations... people saying, oh my God, if the kids are exposed to this, they're going to do it. Mm.
They're smarter than that.
The oldest theory in the book. And then what you find out is that the people that are doing bad things, it's usually because of some other element, some other trigger. And the video game might be somehow involved, but you need the other mental illness in place in order to act out.
Yeah. If your father put cigarettes out on your forehead, chances are, the game, it could be a game about flowers and how many flowers you can find, you'll still go out and do bad things.
Exactly.
It's a cycle of that sort, you know. And I think your brain genetically switches off about what reality is and what fake reality is.
Totally. And I mean, that goes all the way back to Frank Zappa's, debate that he had with the PRMC in Washington, who were trying to label rock albums and things like that.
He was a huge, he was an advocate for that. Oh, gosh. Yeah. I have two Frank Zappa albums that I live for, and that's Joe's Garage and Shiku Booty. And I think they would be considered his commercial albums. Joe's Garage was a pretty big album back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, everybody I knew had Zappa was a huge hero of mine when I was a kid. One of the things that always fascinated me about him was he was several different artists in one and did so many different types of music and was so talented in so many different ways as an instrumentalist, as a writer, as a conceptual artist, as a humorist, as a political voice. Yeah. And, he still is fascinating to me. As a character, I still listen to his stuff all the time. Yeah. Usually, the earlier albums.
So, as a prolific songwriter, Frank Zappa or John Lennon? You know what I mean? Like, where do you sit with that? Like, I'm a Frank Zappa fan before John Lennon fan. Because all those things you're saying is something that John Lennon kind of did, like getting into a bag, doing crazy things.
I have sort of mixed feelings about John Lennon simply because I think some of the stuff that he did politically and, within the sort of social movement that he was trying to push, I found to be a little bit silly or disingenuous. I didn't, and I know it's terribly politically incorrect because John Lennon is one of those artists that is on the list. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by the list is it's the artists you cannot say anything bad about ever. And that list does exist, and it's annoying as all hell, and I don't care about it.
Yeah.
Okay? Joni Mitchell, Lou Reed, John Lennon, like I could name a whole bunch of, you're not supposed to say anything bad about them. I don't care. When John Lennon did that promotional video for Imagine in his $20 billion mansion, all colored in white, talking about Imagine, there's no country, Imagine, no possessions. I'm sorry. As a teenager, I looked at that and I said, what the hell is this guy on about?
Yeah. Driving driving a Rolls Royce that has psychedelic paintings all over
it. Yeah, I just, disingenuous. And if you read about what he did with his kid and mm-hmm. his first wife and stuff. This was not a terribly nice person.
I think
he was a great artist.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think John Lennon had a good 30-year run of having a pass. I think people are starting on the cusp of starting to say things like, because I've read a few of the books and I've and heard some stories, obviously from passed down. They might not be correct stories, but when you read the book by his wife, when you talk about when he backhanded her and she went back to him and things like that, he was a wife beater. He'd tell his kid, like, Julian, you laugh funny. You laugh stupid. These things are all coming out and will come out. And I don't think, you know, and I think Paul McCartney and George Harrison obviously will live into, you can't say anything wrong about Paul McCartney. You can't say anything wrong about George Harrison.
Yeah. Well, I think George is on that list. But the funny thing is it's not only, you know, like we were talking before about what artists or musicians want to get out of music by doing it. Mm-hmm. It's also how we as consumers or observers or members of society, what we want to get out of those people.
Yeah.
Are they meant to be role models? Are they meant to be gods? Mm-hmm. Are they meant to, what are they meant to be? Mm-hmm. Because you know what? There's an awful lot of great artists that are big a-holes. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, and I've actually posed this question periodically to people, is it wrong to listen to music made by somebody who politically you don't agree with or you think's a big a-hole? So, for instance, are you still listening to Ted Nugent? If you're a hard left-leaning person, I'm sorry, you hate Ted Nugent and you call him all kinds of names and he's terrible and he's awful.
Tango's awesome, though.
That's right. So do you still listen to it? And then on the other side of the fence, you've got people like Roger Waters who have done and said some things that are very, very questionable. Mm. That guy flew a pig with a Star of David on it at one of his audiences, one of his concerts. And I think he did it through the whole tour, in fact. So that's going to, you know, bring out a lot of feelings in a lot of people. Yeah. So you've got artists that take these positions. You know, are we still supposed to listen to them? Or are you supposed to say, no, I'm banning them?
Yeah.
It's a very interesting question.
Yeah. There, to me, there's gray, obviously. Like, I worked with people who are assholes, but they're great musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Ashley MacIsaac is one of those people. He's terribly hard to work with. But I think he's brilliant,
right?
As a you know, musician. He's had very, very, well, we could have a whole thing about him. But I've worked for people who are the nicest people in the world. They suck. They're a horrible band.
Yeah.
But I like those people too.
Yeah.
So I would rather work for the people that suck, that are good people, who have good morals, rather than work with the people that would generally be self-destructive and purposely put themselves into a spiral for the sake of, because of their own weakness.
Well, I think there's a lot, you know, one thing that I talk a lot about to people is how much mental illness and trouble there is within the world of rock and roll. Mm. There are a lot of outcasts, a lot of criminals, a lot of people who have different types of problems. And it's always kind of been that way. Mm-hmm. And then you get into the situation of people using it as a license, you know, drugs, alcohol. Oh, sorry, man, I was really high, or whatever it is. They have the license to behave a certain way. You know, I realize I'm talking very maturely right now.
But the
reality is, none of that stuff really creates a valid license.
Yeah.
You know, I really don't care if you were drunk. I really don't care if you were stoned. I really don't care.
Yeah.
If you're behaving like an idiot, you're an idiot.
Yeah. But some people, it's like a circus act where people say, look at this circus act. What's going to happen at this show? And I'm kind of interested to see what spectacle can be made out of this show.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for a band that said, the management said, you can do anything you want that's illegal or wrong. Just videotape it. You know what I mean? So it's like, well, all right, well, I'm your tour manager and I'm the one that could get thrown in jail over this. So.
And I'm also talking as an old guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's face it, I'm an old guy now.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, if doing this interview when I was 18 or 19, it might have been very, very different. The responses would have been different.
Yeah. If you didn't have coffee made for you in your own boardroom, it'd be a different difference.
It'd be a different deal.
You'd be tipping it over.
I just remember the one thing that really concerns me is politically how the world has shifted to a very hard right and a very hard left, mm-hmm. and not a lot in the center. Mm-hmm. And I'm a classic centrist, mm-hmm. and I learned, you know, through various experiences in my life, not to belong to any political club. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the new wave ethic as well from the 70s is I'm not going to belong to any club. I don't care.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you consider yourself to be a left or a right wing person, you know that you're supposed to believe A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And you will argue and fight to the death over those issues.
Being so polarized.
Yeah. And I hate it because I'm issue driven.
Yeah.
I'm going to look at things, you know, one thing at a time. I had a really, really incredibly powerful experience when I was 18 years old and I was living in Ohio, with some of the Dead Boys guys. And one of them had a sister that had gone to Kent State. And this wasn't that long ago. You know, the killing, it was, you know, 10 years, 9 years, and she had been there during the time that it happened. So, you know, me being a kid and, you know, being more left-leaning, etc., I made the comment that it was terrible and disgusting and how could they do it? And she was a philosophy major, and she just started smiling, and this funny little smile, and I said, "What?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "Let me explain something to you." And I said, "What?" She said, first of all, the kids burned down the center where they were, the recruitment center,
yeah.
which is actually an act of war in the United States, mm-hmm. if you burn any mm-hmm. military facility. Mm-hmm. She said the kids were, she goes, you know those pictures of the kids putting little flowers mm-hmm. in the guns? She said, that's lovely, except what they didn't show you were the kids that were urinating in cups and coming and throwing the cups of urine in the faces of the soldiers. Mm-hmm.
Humanity at its worst. Yeah.
So I'm sitting here listening to all this and I'm going, oh, you mean there's like another side to the story?
Oh, yeah.
And she was not justifying the shootings. No. I mean, my God, not even close.
She's putting a little bit of a perspective.
Yes, yeah. Just trying to show you the whole picture as to how certain behaviors can be ignited or triggered. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we see it with things like Ferguson and with the Garner situation in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very difficult to step back and really look at things and then make your decision accordingly.
Yeah. And even when the Kent State massacre, there was the press was involved, but not like it is today.
No.
Today, people can make them spin their own story and it can already be on the news about how bad of a person you are.
That's right.
Before you've even gone to trial.
And it's all on cell phones and it's all out there.
Yeah.
But I find it disheartening that people feel that they need to be so polarized and so extreme with their politics.
I think I'm with you. I think when someone asks me, I work a lot of religious shows where I work.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and when someone says, if you're not in that club, it's speak about polarized. If
you're
not with God, you're going to hell, you know? So when someone says, do you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ? I say, well, if it stops you from getting on a clock tower and shooting people, go for it. If it makes you a civilized person in society and not walk across bus stops using your texting your cell phone, not being a dick, go for it. Praise God. You know what I mean? And I think that is, I think I'm trying to say is I agree with you. I think there is a, you can't be a complete leftist or on the right side because then you've picked a side.
Yeah, and you're a sheep.
And how do you benefit from that as a person? Like to the person, like we were talking about before, you're moving through life, you're doing this and that. Well, the 18-year-old and the 45-year-old me, we have 44, 45 next year.
Yeah,
we have
not there yet.
We have that 18-year-old in me and. You know, me now, we would hate each other.
Right.
And it goes back to your pogo thing, is that the last pogo is that you can't be that. You can't be 58 years old and wear Doc Martens.
No.
Sorry.
That's it.
Or have a mohawk.
It's evolution.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's evolution of you as a person, just like it's evolution of your thought system and your belief system, etc. Everything evolves. And is determined by your life experience. If you have kids, it's going to do something to you.
Yeah.
If you have grandkids, it's going to do something to you. So yeah, it's really interesting. And my relationship to music now is fascinating because I do it for the love of doing it and yeah. for the, I hate using that word spiritual. There's got to be another word. It's just, I don't know, cathartic. Artistically fulfilling. It's yeah. cathartic. Yeah. I like hitting the drums. I like hitting them hard. I like yeah. the primal feeling. I like yeah. the fact that I don't think of anything else when I'm doing it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not thinking about work. I'm not thinking about anything. I'm just thinking about that moment mm-hmm. in the music. And mm-hmm. I have, you know, successfully found people to play with now that, you know, have sort of a shared view, shared feeling.
Realistic. This is, we're here. And yeah. it's not for the bucks. It's for the love. And
there are no bucks.
Yeah, yeah. The bucks would be we get some beer and maybe have a laugh or two and
yeah.
maybe get a bagel or some food.
Yeah. I mean, what I do with my music money when I make any music money is I buy music with it. Mm-hmm. That's what I do personally.
Like music's like instruments and
I'll buy instruments or I will buy stuff off iTunes or I mm-hmm. will buy CDs. Yeah, I basically yeah. just recycle fill my music money. So if I make $100 playing music, I'm going to, yeah,
that's
I'm
amazing. Just going to buy me, like me, my recording studio. That's why you see such old shoddy microphones.
They're not that bad.
We were laughing about it because you're setting it up in this beautiful room that has scuffless. And then I'm like looking at my mic stands going, oh my God, this stuff looks horrible.
The mic stands are, you know, road worn.
They are
in the same way that I am.
Believe me, I've taken these things across Canada 20 times recording bands out of the back of my van, man. Like these things, I think even the logo on there.
They've been used. They could tell a story.
That's right.
They could tell a story.
And they're better than these new K&Ms that I got from work that are breaking left and right and center. Like right. It's weird. They've made mic stands cheaper.
Yeah.
You figure they make them better. Yeah. So you are, your profession, we've really kind of not really hit on that. Like, you're a musician's lawyer. You are...
Yeah.
And what made you get into that? Was that something... Was that part of your dad speaking to you, saying, do something, pick up what we like to call a trade of sorts? So you're close to music, yet you're still... You're making money because, you know... You can disassociate yourself between music business and music.
I mean, yeah. I mean, what happened with me is in the late 70s, I fully expected still to be in bands and that would be my life. By time the mid 80s came around and there were drum machines and computers making music and all that, the world had changed a lot. My relationship to music had changed a lot. And those seeds that were planted by my parents started to sprout, and that was a problem. And I started getting scared of a number of different things. I was scared by the darkness and negativity of the environment in the music business Jaded, yeah. and being on the road and sometimes the guys I was playing with. I was really disturbed by the fact that I didn't know anything other than how to play drums. That's all I knew, and it was bugging me. I didn't read on the road. I didn't. I never read books mm-hmm. or did anything like that. I couldn't. It would make me sick. And traveling vehicles, yeah. I couldn't. Yeah. And so my life was like TV and sitting in the basement, writing songs, touring, blah, blah, blah. And I started to feel like I was wasting part of my life. And then I was also getting really scared about the future. And I did not want to be borrowing money from my parents to pay rent and all mm-hmm. that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. I just didn't. Mm-hmm. And that's what pushed me back to school. So when I was in school, through the first round, I was with the Jitters mm-hmm. in Toronto. So I played with the Jitters throughout undergrad mm-hmm. and then joined Strange Advance.
Is this Heyday Jitters?
Yeah, 1983.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
early Jitters.
Yeah. And then what happened is when I started law school, I was still in the Jitters. Mm-hmm. I was on the album cover. I had to do the video with them because I was on the album cover, but I was not on the record.
Oh, wow.
And okay. I had to leave. I left / got fired.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was going through a very, very difficult time emotionally, as you can imagine,
yeah.
making this huge, huge
transition.
Switch in my
yeah.
life. And the guys pushed me out, and they had to push me out because I was, you know, trying to juggle both, and he couldn't do it. They were going to go on the road. They had all kinds of plans. And quite frankly, I don't think my drumming was right for them at that point, because it was an era where if it wasn't drum machines on the records, it was guys playing like drum machines on the records, which I never did.
Yeah.
So my, as I've said on many occasions to people when they ask me, my style went out of style. And I think I would have been fine in the 90s, and I think I would have been fine in the 2000s.
Yeah.
But in the 80s, my style was out.
That's right. It's all about gated reverb and yeah. triggering that 808 underneath your kick drum stuff and playing like a robot. Yeah,
yeah you didn't, you know, guys that played like me, it was a rarity. Mm-hmm. And
did you try?
Yeah, like when I was in Strange Advance, I had to play with click tracks, and I had to play with computerized percussion and all this other stuff behind me. But I always felt like I was like my hands were sort of chained behind my back, and you know, every part of the show was worked out and was the same every night. And we had this double drum solo that we used to do, me and Drew Arnott, who was the keyboard player and the guy who wrote all those fabulous songs like Worlds Away and We Run and everything. We would do this double drum solo because Drew could play some drums, so he had this like small little thing set up on stage. But if I would improvise during that solo, it would upset those guys. and I, you know, the more upset they would get, the more compelled I was to do
back.
It
yeah.
and to start doing, you know, silly things like I like to do, because, you know, part of the way I play is based in humor. You know, when I'm standing up and on my stool, or I'm, you know, throwing my arms around, or whatever it is I happen to be doing, part of it is because it's funny.
Yeah, you're bringing it.
And I'm amusing myself.
Yeah.
And I hope people are amused watching me.
Yeah, you know who does that, and to a lesser degree, is Jason Tate, who is now of Bahamas, who was in the Weaker Bands. That guy can play. We did, my band toured with him in Europe, and he would do these crazy straight ass solos in one of their most like melodic, quiet song. He'd be like, total left field, like, what the fuck is he doing? And then he'd be laughing in the back just because he's same thing, keeping himself amused. And
it can be, music can be incredibly funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people take themselves so seriously.
Yeah.
And I don't. Mm-hmm. Never have, never will. To me, it's not that serious a venture, you know. I think if you are of a certain echelon, you know, perhaps it is serious. Perhaps the whole thing is very different. But you know, old Genesis, when Peter Gabriel was their vocalist, Selling England by the Pound and Foxtrot and Nursery Crime, those records that I love, there's a lot of humor. On those records.
Yeah.
And his stage presentation had a lot of humor in it, too.
Oh, yeah.
And there was no more serious music on the planet than what they were doing.
Oh, yeah.
But,
musically, it was way out there.
But very deep British humor, you know.
Silly.
Locked in there. Yeah. And it's funny because you mentioned Split Enz earlier. I loved Split Enz at the beginning of their career, when Tim Finn was the main singer.
Yeah, it was more prog back then.
Very prog-like and weird. A strange combination of genres and fascinating stuff. And, of course, the unique look they had and the theatrics. I loved it. I thought they were so interesting.
Tim Finn just put a new album out, I think it was this year or last year, called The View Is Worth the Climb.
Oh, that's
cool.
And
it's a really good album.
It's a great name.
And my wife is the scratch mark of whether it's good or not, because she has very picky, you know, musical taste.
Right.
And if she can listen to that and go, I really like this, and put it on by herself, then I think we got a winner. It's a great album.
That's
and you can tell his voice is—he's getting in there. He's getting old. I think he's pushing 70, 65.
Oh, I think he's got to be up there, because I think he was up there back then.
Yeah.
You know, it's so funny. I was talking about Max Webster the other day, and the fact that their keyboard player Terry Watkinson, who's in his 70s now. He wasn't a young guy back then.
No.
You know, like you could be 30 years old and still look cool,
yeah,
and still come off young.
You can do that in Germany now, still.
Right.
Like, look at the Scorpions.
Right.
It's my second Scorpions podcast mentioned, by the way, sorry. Redundancy alarm.
But the fact is, you know, you then fast forward 40 years, and all of a sudden, you know, you're a 70-year-old.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny how that
Then you're the drummer in April Wine.
Yeah.
Who's right. 70s.
Jerry.
I worked one April Wine concert as a guitar tech, and he rode in on an RV with his kids and grandkids, and I was like a whole, like, yeah.
It's crazy.
And you look at those old videos from him playing and thinking he was 40 years old.
That's like, right.
When that I Like to Rock, I think it was like almost 40.
Right, that's crazy.
It's insane.
Ian Hunter is another one.
Uh huh. Yeah.
I think Ian Hunter used to wear the sunglasses to, in part, hide the crow's feet.
Yeah.
And because he's well in his 70s as well, and can still sing and
still
play.
Go there, yeah.
Yeah.
And Kim Mitchell is definitely somebody who I respected in the Max Webster days. Definitely for holding the Canadian flag strong, and people always put him as the Max Webster as the Canadian Frank Zappa.
Yeah, which I think is somewhat accurate. I mean, yeah. I think they were
later Zappa, like the
yeah. I think they were an incredibly special band.
Oh yeah,
that needless to say, did not get their due and did not have the level of success, even though they were successful and had
a culty band.
Yeah, but they had a level that, let's face it, most people never reach.
Yeah,
but they deserved more. They were so incredibly good. Mm-hmm. And the first one, two, three, four, the four albums, the first four albums,
yeah,
I think are all brilliant.
Million Vacations?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Million Vacations, Mutiny Up Our Sleeve, and High Class and Borrowed Shoes, and the first one. I think those are four brilliant records.
Oh, Blockheads is, there's another album that changed my life because I too had older siblings that would bring home things like the first or second Boston album and bring home Blockheads by Max Webster. And I remember going, oh my God, what the hell is this stuff?
Yeah.
Toronto Tontos. It's like, this is blowing me away. I'm like 6, 7 years old listening to this going, this is crazy. And it's so funny now that my kid listens to the Ramones and says, it's his cool factor, right? Well, for me, I was listening to going, this is crazy stuff. My friends will hate me if I bring this in. Wait a minute, this isn't,
I remember a friend of mine in high school, talking to me about the Ramones. They had been written up in, I think it was Circus Magazine or Cream, I can't remember. And a guy from school came up to me and said, you got to hear this band. And I said, why? And he wasn't saying you got to hear them because he thought they were good. Mm. He said, you got to hear this record. Mm. There's no guitar solo on the whole album.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? And he was like, yeah, they don't even know how to play. They don't know how to play. And it's
not really true.
Hilarious comment because, I've heard Mark Bell, their drummer, say this on occasion. Mm. You try and play downstrokes only on guitar or bass or hi-hat at that speed all night long. Go ahead, try it and see how far you get. Because I know there was a great story about Clem Burke playing with them for a while and he couldn't keep up. He could not keep up. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you right now, I would never be able to keep up. There's no way. It's eighth notes on the hi-hat played at a mile a minute. Yeah. It's all in the fingers.
Yeah, yeah.
If you fall into a trap, which I always do, of playing too loud, you're dead.
Oh, yeah.
You're
dead.
Yeah. You got to play really, really quietly and allow the sound man to do his best.
Do his thing,
But my problem, and it's been my playing problem my whole life, is I get too excited. And when I get excited, I start playing through the drum and I start playing too loud and it's a problem. But I've always just accepted the fact that it's worth it to feel the excitement.
Oh yeah.
So I'm willing to compromise technique to experience that
the feeling.
And
we did some recording together a couple of years ago now.
Yeah.
The Arson record. And when John Sutton says that's the best record I ever played on, John Sutton, ex of Weaker Thans, ex of played in so many different bands, when he says that's the best record I ever played on, it tickles my heart. And to people that probably don't know this, only the closest people to David know that we had 2 days set aside to record that stuff.
Yeah.
And you came in and started. We started at, 6 o'clock? 7 o'clock?
Yeah.
5, 6 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
Because it was started, maybe in the afternoon. But how many songs did we do in literally under 8 hours?
11.
It took less time to get the drum sounds. Now, I must admit, it took a little longer to mix at the back end because of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that record smokes. Like, it's such a solid album. And I got to tell you, it grew for the better of all the parts summed together. That's mm-hmm. what made that so good. And Sutton kind of didn't really know his stuff when he was coming into it, or he was learning it on the fly.
Yeah.
He took it to his apartment, did some bass on it. This album grew out of what I thought was just a bunch of garage guys, and it grew into an album.
Very organic. Yeah. You know, we were in the parking lot before we came into the studio choosing which songs we were going to do. So we didn't even have the final list of the songs until we walked in. Yeah. And then you made it so comfortable for us as a producer. Yeah. It was so easy, and it felt so natural, and there wasn't anybody telling you what to do. And the environment at the studio in Uxbridge is so beautiful, and just opens up your mind, allows you to concentrate on the music.
Yeah.
And we had a really good time.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, we're there for the right reasons, which is, you know, to do it because we want to make music, not because we care about making money, and not because we're trying to get a record deal or a hit.
Yeah.
You don't care.
Yeah, you're documenting something that was obviously a catalog that had spread for years, right?
Yeah.
Like, way beyond, even like one of the first songs you wrote as a band together and things like this. Like, and for me, I really found, like, it took a long time to get that studio tuned in where people weren't just falling asleep.
Right.
Because it's in the middle of, it's like, for the people at home, it's in a barn.
Yeah.
It's set up about half an hour north of Oshawa, and it's in the fields, and it's quiet, and there's no Starbucks, and there's no, you know, and the whole about location recording, that's it to a T. All we need is some cabins, and we could start, you know, making it into a studio.
I mean, I felt like, I remember when I drove up and I came in, and there were the old cars and everything, and I felt like Levon Helm, you know? And it's like, and not musically, but just in terms of the vibe of it all. It's like, the vibe is, it was all about music.
Yeah.
This has nothing to do with anything else other than making the stuff you're going to make.
Yeah.
And that's what I really loved about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, that feeling of not thinking about anything else.
I think that's what helped it along. I really do.
Yeah.
I think what helped the whole process was that I had no idea who I was actually recording at the time. I just thought it was a bunch of guys that John knew, and I've known John for years.
Right.
And I knew that you had, you know, obviously everybody had played before, but I didn't know to, what I learned about something about myself is that when I'm producing or recording my own music, you need people to make this happen, you know, and it's a bit cliche, but you make a group to make that happen. And it's, so I'm really trying to reconnect with people that I had recorded with over the years to make music with them. It's really easy to sit in your own room and strum away and play the drums and then play the bass, and but you're missing something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, and I think that rekindled that idea, you know, in me, that it does take a bunch of people to make something awesome.
Totally. And and different attitudes, you know. Sutton is kind of like the kind of person that goes by feel and feel alone. So, you know, you were there, we would do two takes, three takes. I would say, let me do it again, or let me hear it. And he would say, no, it's done. Let's move on. Next.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I was like, I responded and reacted to that so much.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, okay, yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
Right? So it's that sensibility, and he's younger than us, but it's the it comes from the same kind of place.
Yeah.
And yeah, Rude and Marcel had written some of those songs from 77, 78. And it was a really fun experience.
Yeah.
And it's too bad that there's no, you know, music, I don't know what you want to call it, music industry, music whatever, or even interest in that stuff. Like, I think the kind of stuff we do, there's, you know, not that much interest anymore. It's like,
no. It's to make a CD now isn't really that important, you know.
No.
You could sell that online, and my whole benchmark of whether or not that we're in the digital age is if my mom can go to BitTorrent and go download the new, you know, the latest Coronation Street.
Yeah.
And that to me is like, that's okay. We don't need CDs anymore.
No.
We're done.
The physical part of the business is pretty much done. And
yeah.
And the reality is the monetization part of the business is
It's all about touring and playing shows now. So, which is a bad thing for bands that don't really play in front of a lot of people. So you can't really, you know, do that. You know?
The competition's so heavy in terms of the concert dollar. Mm-hmm. I've gone to see bands that I really loved, you know, who had made several records and stood there being part of 150 people in the audience and going, oh my God, like this is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, the mods used to be able to draw this times two on a Thursday night. Well, the fact is that was a different time and kids didn't have video games and kids didn't have all these other distractions and there weren't 4,000 bands that all sounded the same and it was a different time.
Yep. You had two major channels on TV and not 400 channels of high definition and it's I mean the whole thing is that so we're in a flux. I think something's going to happen. Like somebody's going to figure something out. We always do.
And it'll be subcultural.
Yeah.
You know, which is fine because, you know, seeing all these bands doing their own stuff, their own vinyl, their own recordings, there's something that reminds me of 1977 and the whole thing because that's what we were doing. And it's to bypass a system, to take control of it, do it yourself and forget about the system.
Yeah.
That's what people are having to do now. They're forced to do it.
And almost, like it's almost a good thing for that to put that competition back in. And, you know, I was reading up a little bit about when the major labels were being contemplating software, you know, selling, purchase, and, you know, about downsizing and restructuring. They're like, nope, we're good. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to go wrong in our great, you know, music industry. And look what happened. I mean, like, I was listening to a radio show or a podcast the other day that was talking about Bitcoin and how you could probably make Bitcoin currency for music. The Bitcoin itself is the data which holds the music.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, if you want my song, I can give you my song, but I don't have it anymore. And that's essentially stopping copying. It's essentially, it turns it into I have this piece of paper and it's only around once. So Bitcoin is how, I don't know if you know much about Bitcoin, but Bitcoin is a new type of money that's being developed. And, and it only goes to a certain amount. That's, I think, 24 million Bitcoins.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one Bitcoin right now is like $200.
Okay.
So what happens is if I say, you want my song? Well, I have 20 Bitcoins. 20 Bitcoins is 20 songs. And I'm going to give you my song. Or you give me a Bitcoin and I'll give you my song, which is another Bitcoin. So therefore, I don't have the song anymore. I've given it to you.
Yeah.
And I think that's a way that, you know, that could combat the whole sharing and downloading and things like that, you know.
It's a huge sociological problem because you've got people that have now been born into this and have been raised this way, that music is free, but also that music is a huge world of saturation. And it's very, very difficult to sort of pick through stuff to find the good things. Well, it's very hard. It wasn't hard like that when we were kids. There was only so much out there. Now, if you're into, you know, death metal, there's 17 billion death metal bands, Norwegian death metal, Swedish death metal. So it's not like when we were kids, you had Zeppelin, Deep Purple, Black Sabbath, you know, Aerosmith.
Yeah, and someone could like, say Rush and Frank Zappa, or Saga, or you know what I mean? Like there was a little less judgmental of what genre they were actually into. And I think now because they're so pigeonholed, you can pigeonhole that band into that genre.
Oh yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you know, and it sort of goes back to our polarizing what you like and do not like. And I think it kind of goes against what you think music should be about. I think that if you like music, it should be about the feeling. And because of Justin Bieber, it's now kind of ruined. But if someone just sang baby, I've been saying this for years. If someone said baby, 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 but they meant it, I can subscribe to it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's me in music. If I find the positive part of it, I can get into it, you know, and that's just me. And I think
you're looking for a sincerity.
Yes.
in the music, and it doesn't really matter what genre it is if it's got the sincerity in it.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's what Frank Zappa used to call a certain smell. You know, his music had a certain smell to it. You knew it was him. And that's what I've always looked for, are bands that have a certain smell. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of uniqueness to it. Mm-hmm. There's something that sets it apart. I don't really care what genre it is either, if it hits me in that particular way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I fear that that whole approach to listening to music and consuming it is becoming very subcultural. Mm-hmm. And kids don't have enough time. You know, let's face it, we were sitting there poring over liner notes and photos and learning the names of band members. And I hate the fact that that stuff still inhabits my brain and takes up space in there. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, do you want to know who played in Free? I'll tell you who played in Free.
Paul
you know,
Rogers.
It's like, yeah, Paul Rogers and Paul Kossoff and Andy Fraser and Simon Kirk. Why do I need to know this stuff? And why do I need to remember it? Well, because I memorized it as a kid and it's in my head.
It'll
but it's
there.
It's also enabled me to maintain the love that I had for it.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that
ownership.
I poured it into me like that and absorbed it like that.
Yeah.
And it's an experience that a lot of kids now don't have.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God my 19-year-old, he's had that experience.
Mm-hmm.
He listens to music that nobody knows about amongst his friends because he's done the research and some of it through me and some on his own. And he likes some really, really cool stuff.
Mm.
You know, he loves Porcupine Tree and guys like Jason Faulkner. He loves Elliott Smith. He likes really, really good music.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. Because
mm-hmm.
if I had a kid that was in all that crap, and I do mean crap,
mm-hmm.
that's out there, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about like the generational gap of saying, oh, that's crap. I'm saying some of it's crap.
Yeah.
And I got a pretty goddamn open mind, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I can listen to Deer Hoof, mm-hmm. and I can listen to Cursive and, you know, Dismemberment Plan. I love all that kind of stuff. I like Marilyn Manson. I don't have a problem with all kinds of music, but I do have a problem with talentless shit.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, part of the music business now is inhabited by people that don't have any talent.
Yeah.
And that to me is brutal.
Well, they have talent, but they're the ones working in the high rises that are making that talent sale. I mean, Florida Georgia Line. It's like I've said, this is another podcast, the redundancy alarm, but I said it's like it's written by retarded five-year-olds, the lyrics.
Right.
Going to play a little this, a little that. Like, are you trying? Do you think I'm stupid?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think you're trying to sell me snake oil.
Yeah.
And I can't subscribe to, I don't care if you're at a party. You know what I mean? That doesn't, I can't. And I've worked a few country festivals over the past couple of years where it's like, I feel like it just got rid of the bad hair from the 80s metal bands and put a cowboy hat on.
Right.
It's the exact same attitude. It's the same vibe where people are like, you know, we're in Dirkley or whatever, like name a country guy, you know, like,
yeah.
Well, good for you. You got your big number one song, but I've toured on the Warped Tour, and, you know, and this is not what I can, you know, get into.
I mean, I'm offended by what's happened to music vis-a-vis female artists,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, I look at the female artists that you know were really good and succeeded when I was a kid, and
mm-hmm.
and there were many brilliant female artists,
mm-hmm.
and now I look at it, mm-hmm. and I'm not, you know, necessarily criticizing someone like Beyonce. Beyonce mm-hmm. is an incredible singer, mm-hmm. an incredible dancer, a wonderful entertainer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have a problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the person I was mentioning to you earlier, Iggy Azalea, this is someone who is getting lots of attention and, you know, has become really, really big in the industry because she's got a big ass.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently having a big ass is part of getting success. And then you need to take that big ass and you need to dance and twerk and shove it in people's faces like you're a porn star.
Yeah.
Well, I just, you know, read something the other day that Chrissy Hynde had said from The Pretenders. She's calling, a lot of people are calling it pop porn.
Yeah.
Which is right. Literally is soft pornography mixed with pop music.
Yeah.
And Chrissy Hynde was saying, if you want to do porn, just do it.
Yeah.
Like, why not just do it?
Yeah.
And leave music alone.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I feel about it. I don't have a problem with pornography. You want to do pornography, go do it.
Yeah.
But leave music alone. And
yeah.
and don't ruin what's there. You know, to mm-hmm. me, it's like, it would be like taking, you know, beautifully creative hockey players and putting them on the ice, and all of a sudden it's been reduced to just taking your stick and smashing it over the head of the other guy mm-hmm. and not even carrying the puck.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's what they've done to music.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the movie Idiocracy, the Mike Judge film?
No.
It's basically Luke Wilson and a prostitute get cryogenically frozen for 100 years. And they get reanimated, and they are the smartest people on earth. And like the question is like, hey, how do I, you know, the first thing they do is they earn a mountain of water bottles, empty water bottles. Yeah, I suggest watching that movie because it really does it. It sort of like tells, first of all, it shows like the smart family, the smart couple going,
yeah.
Well, it's not time to have kids yet. And then it shows the trailer park family, and there's like, bing, 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 kids being born. And what it essentially says is people become more and more dumb because the dumb people are having more kids because they're not smart enough to understand that they shouldn't be having kids. And then the smart ones are like, they're too smart, so they're thinking, overthinking, and then it turns out it shows just the wife because the husband died of cancer.
Oh,
so there's
funny.
No kids on the lawyer family. You know?
Right,
but
right,
then there's
right.
shows the trailer park family with like hundreds of kids, and
oh,
it's like,
man.
And this is what happened to society after this period of time.
Yeah.
You know, and but I think that's where we're going. It's unfortunate. But we shouldn't leave off on such a negative note. We should reel this back in and say, What makes you happy about music? Like I you know, we've touched on several different things, and the centrism part I can totally subscribe to. Yeah,
yeah,
I love that.
I think my relationship with music now is the healthiest it's ever been in my whole life, in the sense that I not only love making music, but I have a kind of a fandom feeling right now mm-hmm. At my age that I really enjoy. I'm mm-hmm. still a huge fan of stuff. I love the emotional connection of listening to things that I heard when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I love certain songs that I will never turn off mm-hmm. when they come on.
Yeah.
And it's not because they're the best songs in the world. It's because they meant something to me and continue to mean something to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the feeling that I get from that, because you can't get that feeling from anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
when I hear Baby Blue by Badfinger, it does something to me. I will not turn that song off ever.
Yeah.
When I hear, you know, certain Big Star songs, we were talking about Big Star before,
yeah.
it's the same thing. You know, and it's just because those songs meant something to me emotionally, and they take me back to certain places. So I love that. But I also love discovering new things and interesting stuff that people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if it sells or it doesn't sell.
Right.
I just love that the spirit is there and that people are still fighting to make great music.
Yeah.
And I love it when I get to discover that.
Yeah. And I think where it more of a cream rises to the top, unfortunately, there's millions of layers of cream as opposed to 20 years ago when there may have only been three.
There is.
So your level of getting up to the cream is a lot of crap along the way. But discovery, like you said, I've discovered a few bands over the past 5 years that have blown me away. But I still feel that I can only really relate to the music that I listened to 30 or 20 years ago, unfortunately.
It's hard to escape.
It's hard to escape. But at the same time, it's what makes you happy. There's like, I have obviously have grown my hipster beard and my handlebar mustache and wore like a plaid lumberjack, which is the new hipster look, is lumberjack.
Okay.
Could you imagine
yeah.
those guys out
it's
like
funny.
With an axe? You know, like get out of the woods. Like it's like the SUVs with like low ride, like with the lights underneath it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, there's no way they'd even make it. But so I've yet to put my hipster outfit on, and I kind of still laugh at what people think are hip
yeah.
now. And I'm convinced, you know, you can... Now, the guy from Walk Off the Earth, that five people, one guitar, that pring, the guy that played the headstock.
Oh, yeah,
he
yeah.
had a beard and a cap and kind of looked like a lumberjack.
Right.
They had, what, 75 million
yeah.
like plays on that song, right?
Yeah.
So my theory is that he started that whole hipster lumberjack movement.
You're probably right.
There you go.
You're probably
you heard
right.
it here first, folks.
Maybe that's what I got to do.
Get a beard.
Get
a lumberjack.
Beard. And an axe.
Walk around with an axe around downtown Toronto and you get yourself shot.
The Paul Bunyan Band.
Yeah.
And there you go, David Quentin Steinberg, live in a boardroom in downtown Toronto. This podcast is brought to you by FetchClass.com. FetchClass.com is a learning and teaching online system. It's a membership system as well. Not only can you be teaching, be taught in video conference, but you can also have your scheduling taken care of you, your invoicing paid on a monthly basis. It's an awesome new system, and come on by, check it out, FetchClass.com. So you can tweet me for now at SimonHead666. And tweet me in, retweet this, say whenever I let you know. Follow me, and let's get that count up to 100 people, everybody. It's at 62 right now. 100 people. I want 100 followers on Twitter. I've only been on it for 4 years. So come on, let's get that up. Thanks a lot, everybody, for joining me. Have a good week, and we'll see you again.